There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Wednesday, October the 9th. Importance of working and playing well with others. That's basically what the IMF is telling world leaders to do. Look, we have had overnight two warnings from two people that you should probably take seriously. One's the IMF and one's the World Bank. The World Bank has said that it's probably going to have to revise downwards its last forecast for global growth. The new IMF managing director has stood up and said that they're going to be releasing their world economic outlook in the next couple of weeks. And again, downward revisions for 2019 and 2020. Couple of reasons for this. One, B for Brexit or B for Boris. Two, T for trade wars or indeed T for Trump. Those are the two big factors which has got us thinking about trade, how it's evolving and why it's so important. Because it's very easy to think about things like the US-China trade wars as being, you know, someone else's problem, not really affecting us. Ditto Brexit. If you're not British, if you don't have a house in the UK, if, you know, what does it have to do with you? In fact, it's just a bonus, isn't it? Because now buying stuff online from the UK as the pound continues to fall gets cheaper. But there's a little bit more to it than that.
We got a Twitter poll asking that very question. It's crunch week in the US-China trade war. The talks are meant to begin tomorrow, although the trade dispute escalating overnight with sanctions imposed by the United States relating to human rights, not trade at all. How does it affect you and your company here in the UAE? We're giving you two options. One is, not my problem. B is, yes, I'm worried. Well, two-thirds of people say it's not my problem. Only a third of people are worried. I've voted and I've said I am worried. Not can't sleep at night worried, but when you're making decisions, when you're making investment decisions, you have to be aware that these things are happening. You have to be aware that Dubai is one of the world's leading trade hubs, like a Singapore, like a Rotterdam, and you are in the eye of the storm. Most of the time, that's a good thing, but you have to accept that when these global trade issues happen, you are not immune.
Yeah, and we've been asking an economist, Richard Boxall is the director and senior economist at PwC Middle East, why we should all be caring about trade.
Economists generally support trade or encourage trade because it has a number of benefits. One of the key ones is that if you're a producer of goods or services in a particular country, then when you are able to trade freely with other countries, it just gives you a much bigger market. So there are sell to, you can scale up your business and it provides great opportunities. It also provides opportunities for consumers in the country as well. So you can not only buy your goods and services from domestically based producers, but you can also buy from abroad. And that generally leads to a greater variety of products and services and cheaper prices. And obviously here in the UAE, we benefit a lot from that, from all of the food stuff that we buy in and all of the cars and many of the things that aren't produced here, but we've got a great variety of things here. But also the great opportunities for selling Dubai and UAE-based products and services abroad.
So how has the US-China trade war impacted the UAE?
If we're talking specifically about the US trade war, which I think is one of the key issues on the agenda at the moment, the US-China trade war is happening out there in the global economy. And its direct effect on the UAE is probably quite small as a direct effect. But because of the uncertainty that that's creating in the global economy with the two largest economies in the world, it tends to have effect on other things that influence the UAE economy. And specifically, the oil price. So when the global economy, particularly China, is slowing, then that can lead to weaker oil prices. And that has a direct impact on the region and then again on UAE. And the other one is in on investor confidence. So when investor confidence declines, then you find investors tend to flee towards safer assets in the US. So these are the two ways in which the trade war in the US and China are having an influence here on the region.
We're also going to be looking at how trade is evolving as well. So it's not just about moving boxes off dhows for the UAE at the moment. We'll be speaking to the New Zealand Minister of Trade about this as well. For the UAE, it's also about knowledge transfer. And it's also about food security. It's about making sure that the UAE has access to the stocks of stuff that it needs. And the Business Breakfast spoke to His Excellency Essa Abdullah Al Ghareer, the Vice Chairman of Al Ghareer Investments. His company stores 300,000 tonnes of food grains during a recent Dubai Chambers conference in Panama. And we asked him why the Gulf region needed to focus on things like food security.
Because you see, you can live without shelter. You can have your clothes for 10 days, 15 days, 20 days, but how long you can sustain from not eating? 7 to 21 days. So you cannot go in such a country without having one of the pillars of this is nourishing the people. But I am very happy that the government not only looking at that, but also one of the other things which I always talk about is reduce waste, which is one of the things that they are talking about. And I'm happy to see that this is one of the pillars that they are going to focus on.
Yeah, we also asked Essa Abdullah Al Ghareer whether food security meant not importing goods.
If you look at it in another way, we're going to reduce the carbon print from, you know, bringing some of these things by air or by ship to the region. Some of it will be destroyed because it is rotten, because of the life cycle of these plants or perishable items is short. But if you grow it locally, it will help. We're not saying don't want to import from outside, but we would like to rely on the things that can be done locally, do it. I cannot grow rice. I'll have to import rice, fine. Now, Japan cannot produce oil. They will have to rely on, so everybody will have to complement each other.
There you go, there's trade in a nutshell.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
We are staying with our discussion about the importance of trade in the light of warnings from both the World Bank and the IMF. We are very pleased to be joined on the line now by the New Zealand Minister for Trade and Export Growth, David Parker. He's currently in the UAE and he speaks to us now. You're in Dubai on your way to Europe. Why have you built a stop in here?
Well, the United Arab Emirates is our most important trading partner in the Middle East. It's important both in its own right because we have 9 billion dirham of two-way trade, which is significant for us. But it's also a hub for access into the wider Middle Eastern countries for our exporters. So it's a really, really important relationship for us. It's one that we find very easy and secure, and we like to honour it.
We're talking this morning about the importance of trade. The World Bank's come out and said that it may have to revise down the forecast for global growth. The IMF has said similar. How is New Zealand facing the trade wars that we're seeing between the US and China? What are your concerns about global trade?
Well, we haven't been too hard directly affected yet. But of course, if the world economy slows down because there's a lack of confidence for people to invest in businesses, then everyone is affected to the detriment of our own countries. How we try to ensure against that is we're great believers in the international rule of law relating to trade, which is at the heart of that lies the World Trade Organization. So we try to support those multilateral institutions. But also as another layer of insurance, we have secondary agreements with countries through bilateral free trade agreements or plurilateral agreements amongst a number of countries that provide rules that if you come into stormy waters through the WTO, you've got an alternative rule set to rely upon.
Speaking of free trade agreements, negotiations concluded 10 years ago now for an FTA between New Zealand and the GCC. It still needed to be ratified, though, put into practice. Where are we on that?
Well, it's a little becalmed at the moment, which is a little disappointing from New Zealand's perspective, because, as you say, those long negotiations were concluded, but then there have been some years of delay, actually, on the Middle Eastern side, where countries have yet to resolve some of their differences that are required to be agreed before it can be brought into effect. So we wait, and we're hopeful that those differences can be resolved, because we think that they would benefit both of our peoples.
What difference would that FTA between New Zealand and the GCC make?
Well, one of the things it does is it makes it easier for small to medium-sized businesses to be recognised by our respective countries for trading purposes. Sometimes those rules can be a bit complex and a bit arcane. One of the things that we agree to do under this agreement is share some of the good experiences that we've got in New Zealand. We're the number one in the world for the ease of doing business. And one of the things that we bring to these relationships is to show how you can make it easier for smaller businesses to engage in new endeavours without having to go through too many bureaucratic hurdles before starting.
And what will it take? I mean, you describe this as being becalmed, the FTA. What will it take to get that particular boat sailing again?
That will require upon a push by the Gulf Cooperation Council to resolve their differences.
While you're here, you're going to be visiting the New Zealand Expo Pavilion, which is currently under construction. New Zealand's investing nearly $54 million in that. And back in New Zealand, that sort of money doesn't go unscrutinised. What are you hoping that Expo will do for New Zealand trade?
We're hoping it will demonstrate to the many people from around the world who will be visiting Expo of the huge quality of food and produce that we produce. But in addition to that, the other services and goods that we sell to the world, which are quite diverse. We've got some interesting pockets of capability in New Zealand. We're the first country in the world to have a civil satellite launching service. So little old New Zealand launches satellites into space, micro-satellites, in a way that's disrupted the world satellite industry. So that we're good in some areas of robotics. We're, of course, have got really good environmental services and food security systems that other countries rely upon. So it's a chance for us to show our wares environmentally and try and present the linkages that we have that try to make sure that the benefits of our economy flow through to everyone in an inclusive way.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned some buzzwords there, whether it's inclusivity, whether it's sustainability, food security. We're talking this morning also about how trade deals are evolving, and I know that New Zealand has a big trade for all agenda. How do you put New Zealand's priorities in that way across during trade?
It's sad that some of the international rules relating to environmental outcomes are very, very slow to change. You know, we've got declining fisheries around the world, and yet some of the rules about what we think are improper subsidies of illegal fishing have yet to be fixed. However, you can't give up on fixing those things, and trade agreements can be a way in which you can put a bit of pressure on countries to do a bit better in the future. So try and have provisions to advance environment, human rights, the rights of women, trying to construct our economies in a way that make them accessible to small to medium-sized enterprises. So, and we talk to our people about it too, which is one of the things that we do through our Trade for All agenda, because we like to carry our people with them so that we have a happy and prosperous society.
Well, after the UAE, you are going to be heading up to London, rather. You're going to be discussing your future trade relationship with both the UK and Germany. What challenges does Brexit pose to trading partners of both the UK and Europe?
Well, funnily enough, it was the Great Britain and the United Kingdom leaving their traditional relationships with the likes of New Zealand and Australia and going into the European Union that caused a great upheaval for New Zealand in the 1970s. And in the decades since, we've diversified our trading relationships and have actually become very good and honest brokers at trade agreements. Of course, now that there's these changes afoot for Great Britain, if they exit the European Union, That means that we've got to foster a new trading relationship with the United Kingdom outside of the European Union. We're also in the midst of negotiations with the European Union because we've never been able to get one of those free trade agreements with them, but we're in the middle of negotiations to do so.
Is it a case of wait and see, though? I mean, you're hamstrung to a certain amount, a certain extent, how much you can actually do with the UK until it formally leaves, aren't you?
Yes, we are. You're quite right. Until the United Kingdom knows the terms of their divorce, they can't really negotiate their new trade marriage.
Mr. Barker, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but I like your analogy very much. Ngā mihi, thank you very much for your time. The Honourable David Parker, New Zealand's Minister for Trade and Export Growth.
This is The Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
We're very pleased to be joined by Serena Kelly. What can you tell us?
Well, obviously, we had updates regarding the technical defect on the Dubai Metro's red line. It apparently disrupted some services this morning. So several commuters were left stranded at the Sharif DG Metro station. Officials did take to Twitter to confirm the incident. No other stations have been affected, but buses have been sent to accommodate the passengers at the stop, and they've been transferred to other stations like Mall of the Emirates and Dubai Internet City.
We've been looking at this IATA reporting, and we're talking about how everyone gets around, whether it's metros. We've been talking about refueling with Enoch and the guys at Carrefour. A whacking great amount of jobs.
Yes, that's right. Well, they're also saying that according to the latest report, they've revealed the financial impact that the aviation sector has on the economy. It says it's currently supporting nearly 800,000 jobs in the Emirates. It contributes more than 174 billion dirhams to the economy. That's close to 14% of the UAE's GDP. And it also says that the aviation sector could add another 620,000 jobs and an extra 300 billion dirhams in GDP for the Emirates economy by 2037.
While we are looking at the economy of the UAE, Rich is getting his head around the World Economic Forum's latest study into a competitive economy. Rich, what does it say?
It says we're doing well. Is the short answer. 25th in the world out of 141 countries. Last year, we were ranked 27th, so we're climbing up the rankings. I haven't got all of the details in front of me, but here's what I can tell you. We're the top ranked in the Arab region, once again. Looking at and they break it down, competitiveness, into I think it's 12 different categories. And sort of, we're doing really, really well on things like macroeconomic stability. We're first in the world on macroeconomic stability. Adoption of ICT, information communication technologies, we're second in the world. So we're absolutely trailblazing in things like that. And as a product market, we're fourth in the world. So doing really, really well on that. Room for improvement, where we're not doing so well, we're 92nd in the world for health issues. And I guess that's, I'm speculating here because I've got the infographic rather than the full report in front of me. For privileged people like us with good health insurance, maybe the UAE is a great place to be, but maybe they look at other issues as well. I don't know. I'm speculating as to why we're 92nd in the world.
You're filling in gaps between the graphs is what you're doing.
I am, but 92nd in the world is, but it's certainly not my experience, but of course my experience is not everyone's experience. And also human capital in terms of skills, we're 39th in the world. So we're punching below our weight when it comes to skills. There are other factors as well, but those are the ones. Really, really good macroeconomics, really, really good as a product market. So the economic stuff we're good at, the tech stuff we're good at as well, but it's the human stuff, says this report, where we need to improve.
Interesting to see, though, if we zoom out a little bit. I mean, that obviously, as we're looking at what's happening here in the Arab world, the UAE taking the top spot. Globally, Singapore overtaking the US to be the world's most competitive country. That is the big headline for me this morning.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I haven't had time to drill down into this, but they have knocked the United States off their perch at the moment. The US is in second place. Japan, I see, is sixth. Germany's in seventh. Have you got the full list there?
I haven't, but I'm having a look at some analysis already. Because the US was number one last year, basically. The report's authors do say that it's still a big innovation powerhouse because we're talking about competitiveness here. And it did get the highest score in a number of the categories that are looked at. There's 12 pillars. So the ease of finding skilled employees, the availability of venture capital, they did very well. Can you guess where they might have fallen a little bit in the rankings?
Is there a trade category?
There is. Increasing trade tariffs is the big thing that's done in for the US in this report. Low digital skills as well, apparently, has brought it down. And declining life expectancy. Here's a little factoid for you this morning that's certainly just taken me by surprise. The World Economic Forum has noted that life expectancy in the US is now lower than China. I know someone who's not going to like that particular juxtaposition.
No, they're not, in the context of the trade shenanigans going on and the talk starting tomorrow.
The ongoing opioid crisis is one of the things for that. I do now have the top 10 global list. Number one is Singapore, a city-state that the UAE has a lot, and Dubai particularly, has a lot in common with, and you could say has used Singapore as a model for much of what it's done. Two, the United States. Three, Hong Kong. Will be very interesting to see next year's list and see where Hong Kong appears in that. The other usual characters rounding out the top 10, Sweden and Denmark, Switzerland's up there as well, UK coming in at number 9. Again, let's have a look at next year's list for the most competitive nations. I suspect that it's going to look slightly different.
Very quickly, you were making lots of puns and gags about Pizza Express shutting down. Thank you very much indeed for those. Up all night practicing them, delivered with clarity. But what's the story with the restaurants in the United Kingdom? We've got lots of Pizza Expresses here as well, so that the tentacles reach over here. But some of the issues that you've been looking at that are blighting UK restaurants do resonate here in the UAE as well. I know we've only got a minute or so to look at this,
yeah,
but it's
they
worth
do.
Closer
and,
inspection.
I mean, for Pizza Express, let's not call time on the dough balls just yet, because they have a big pile of debt. They've hired some financial advisors, Bloomberg's reporting this morning. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go insolvent, because they've got till 2021 to settle the debts, but it is really, really worrying at the moment, given what we saw happen to Jamie's Italian, what we've seen happen to Patisserie Valerie, closing 70 of its outlets, more than 70, a number of other restaurants suffering as well. Number of reasons for this. One is the fact that rents are high, as we see here in the restaurant sector, Brexit uncertainty, the lower pound, the higher cost of ingredients. But this is an interesting one. It's almost the optimism of the market. Private equity firms ploughing money over the last couple of years into the casual dining space, thinking, oh, yeah, no, there's room there, which is great until there isn't room there a bit anymore. And you could argue that that's what's going on in the UAE as well. One thing, we build one thing, we think it's great, we build three, it's a few too many.
This is the Business Breakfast on Dubai Eye 103.8.
The authority on the issues that matter.
Let's get some more detail on one of our top stories now. Enoch, the energy company, has launched a mobile refueling service for corporate and fleet customers. The company says it's already testing fuel delivery for consumers. Joining us on the line now is one of Enoch's competitors in this field, the market leader in this field at the moment, CAFU. The general manager is Antonio Al-Azma. Antonio, thanks for being with us. First of all, your reaction to the news that Enoch is getting into the business of fuel delivery.
When we heard the news, we are quite excited here at CAFU of this news. No, we welcome competition. We think it's really healthy. This is what's happening, that they have decided eventually to join us in this new market that we have created. And to be honest, I think this is healthy for the economy, for the end user. Everyone will end up winning the more there is options out there for on-demand fueling.
How strong is demand for on-demand fueling? You were with us when you launched this organization a while ago. Can you give us a sense of what kind of demand you're seeing?
Look, to be honest, things have been growing much faster than even what we were anticipating. So right now we have almost more than 100 trucks. We have been able to do, since our launch, I would say more than 250,000 fields since our launch. So that's been in less than a year. So things have been growing very relatively quite good for us. And we only see it, and that's why we think competition is also joining, because I think they see an opportunity in the market, and this is a win-win for everyone.
Of course, competition is healthy in any business that you're in, but Brandy's been looking at some regulatory issues, and we'd be interested to get your take on these. Brandy?
Yeah, both the National and Gulf News this morning are reporting that Enoch and others are working with the government on regulations, new regulations for on-demand fueling. What do you know about these?
Look, to be honest, at least on the current regulations that are out there, from our side, we are compliant with all the regulations. So we have the right approvals from the civil defense, from the Dubai Economic Department, and from the various authorities that right now regulate this very infant industry. So there is no clear regulation on it right now. Yes, to be honest, we think probably this is the right approach. If eventually the government will go and fully regulate this industry, I think it will also help us, even for us, no? Because any new regulation will make it will make the service better for all our users, whether for us or for them. So it will help everyone, the new regulation.
The CEO, though, of Enoch is quoted as saying in the Gulf News that it's his understanding that only three oil companies can sell, you know, the main providers can sell fuel in the UAE, and that, and I quote, in the future, the government will regulate who is going to be in the market or not. Is that a concern?
Look, to be honest, is that really a concern? Look, at the end, we know what is the vision of this country. We know what the whether what the economic department, the kind of competition they are trying to push in this market. So I would be really surprised that they will go to a kind of approach that's very monopolistic. So I wouldn't be expecting any kind of new regulation that will be very monopolistic or keeping this in the hands of the states. At the end, look, I think everywhere in the world they are going towards open market competition, because that's how you end up having more innovation. And I would be expecting, if there is any new regulation for the on-demand fueling, it will be it will not be monopolistic.
What about cost, though? The Gulf News also quotes a spokesperson from Enoch as saying that as a national fuel provider, they'll be able to supply fuel cheaper than you will. Is that a concern, that you could be undercut?
Look, on the pricing, on the actual price of the fuel, so the price per liter, look, I expect we are all buying more or less from the same sources and we are all getting more or less the same prices. However, so on the actual fuel price per liter, on that one, I don't think they would undercut the price, or else they would have done it in the current gas stations. The only area where I see there could be some undercutting would be on the delivery fee. On that one, look, since we have grown so quickly now and in the current capacity that we have, we are seeing a lot of efficiencies. So yes, at some point in time, even for us, we think there is some room even for us to further improve our delivery fee, once, especially now that we have grown so much and we see a lot of efficiencies. So that should be doable even for us.
A final quick word on what next for Kafir. A few weeks ago, you launched what you're calling Kafir Essentials. You'll now sell us a battery. You'll change our tyres as well, and so on. Where do you take Kafir now?
Yeah, look, for us right now, we are focusing on the future. So we have done the petrol delivery with a success, and now we are looking a bit to change the whole car ownership journey. So, and that's why we are focusing right now on having the essentials with our partners ExxonMobil. We are doing the same also with the car wash, which is to launch that part of the business, along with the tire and the battery change at a later stage. So we are focusing at the end for us to provide a full integrated journey for the customer, anything related to his car ownership. So think of, if I own a car, I need to have Kafir, because this is the right app that will make everything related to my car ownership much more simpler.
Could that include mobile charging for electric vehicles?
We are looking into that. Actually, we had a discussion with our founder, Rashid Al-Ghurair, a few days ago, whereby we were thinking, what do we need to do so we prepare ourselves for mobile fueling? That was coming on a discussion he had with the GM of General Motors, where he was saying that all new cars in 2021 that are Cadillacs will be coming as electrical cars. So we're like, okay, how does that impact us? What can we do? So we are looking at options, to be honest.
Antonio Alasma, General Manager of Kafir. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow morning from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.